Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Dr. Norton Hadler loves practicing medicine, loves doctoring. But he doesn't love what that's become, sliced and diced and timed and hyper-for-profit. The full and proper role of the doctor, he says, is getting lost in production line guidelines and algorithms. He wants it back for you and for doctors. This hour on Point, a call to save what doctoring should be. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Is your doctor really, truly there for you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, is Dr. Norton Hadler, Professor Emeritus of Medicine and Microbiology, Immunology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, author of many books on the medical system. His latest, brand new, is By the Bedside of the Patient, Lessons for the 21st Century Physicians. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Hadler, welcome back to On Point. It's wonderful to have you.
It's a pleasure to be back, Tom. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, it's so nice to have you. We really appreciate your long view, and I want to talk about a lot of the changes that you have seen in the numerous decades, shall we say, that you've been at this by now. But let me read just a little bit for our listeners from your book, where you describe painting here in the book, yourself painting a dismal, even lurid picture of the evolution of the healthcare system from a cottage industry to a conglomerate of patient care assembly lines. And then you talk about caring professionals coming to be time clock providers, marching to tunes played by a bloated, overpaid administration, wedded to a flawed approach to optimizing cash flow, on and on. I mean, the result, you write, is a nation peppered with lumbering, costly, self-serving institutions playing a small role in fostering public welfare and a large role in rifling public coffers. They are ethically bankrupt, highly leveraged houses of cards where doctors are working. That sounds pretty miserable, Dr. Hadler.
Well, it does. But what you won't find in the book is a blame game. I don't have to blame anybody. This is called the social construction of health. And most of us don't realize that health is that kind of a free-floating concept. It means different things at different times. And the reason it changes has to do with this thing called the common sense, which is not particularly common temporally or geographically, seldom sense and easily marketed. And that's been true forever. So what I wrote in this book was not an evolution in the existence of misanthropes, but the evolution in the way we frame the notion of health. And the way we frame it is peculiar to this country. My career has had me as a guest lecturer at most medical schools in this country and many abroad, including long stints abroad. And what I'm going to talk about has nothing to do with one institution, including mine, and nothing to do with the particular players involved. It has to do with what we have constructed as a nation, as the notion of health. Disease, by the way, is a different notion. It tends to objectify itself. It tends to be something that I can measure and I can treat and maybe even cure, and usually not cure, but more often help with. But health is not the absence of disease, and disease is not the absence of health. Both of them interact in a way that varies depending on the context.
So give us a sense. You've been in and around hospitals and medicine for 60 years, a doctor for 45 plus. Over that time, how has our understanding of what health even means changed?
It has changed dramatically at multiple levels, in part because our ability to define the components of disease has changed. And in doing that, we've lost the notion of health. There are a couple of important watersheds in my career. In the 60s, And by the way, almost all of this is unintended consequences of good ideas.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in the 60s, we had two major watersheds. One was the introduction of Medicare, and the other was the Kefauver-Harris amendments to the Food and Drug Administration Acts. Before those two things, medicine and was indeed a cottage industry. We did what we in medicine did to patients, what we were told was the best thing to do. Many have called this eminence-based medicine. The relationship between a patient and a doctor was not on a level playing field. It was, I am doctor, you are patient, mm-hmm. I speak, you listen.
Mm-hmm.
And there was very little available back then that could intercede in that relationship. So people went to the doctor when their world was beyond their control. Very few people go to the doctor for the fun of it. Almost everybody goes to the doctor because they are suffering at some level. And the relationship was one of the supplicant going to the medical priest. That changes in the 60s. That goes back, by the way, for millennia, the notion of I doctor, you patient.
Yep.
In the 60s, it changes, but not dramatically. It changes slowly. And the two things that made it possible for it to change was the development of clinical science, the ability to test our inferences as opposed to just accept them based on who said what,
mm-hmm.
but to actually ask whether or not the inference is tenable if it was tested scientifically. Now, there is a tradition of that that goes back to the Western Caliphates, actually, in Avicenna. It really gains traction about after World War II when the British in particular started to do clinical science where they looked at ways to test clinical inferences. And it gets more than traction but starts to accelerate with the FDA.
You would think this would be a good thing, Dr. Hadler. I mean, clinical science sounds like more information, more understanding, and yet you describe medical professionals these days as, you know, the whole thing is rife with work dissatisfaction, early retirement, you know, layoffs, people getting out as fast as they can. Why wouldn't better clinical science mean more satisfied doctors and patients?
That's the whole thesis of this new book. You're absolutely right. For the first time in history, in my lifetime, by the 70s, we were able to have a very different conversation that spoke to the limitations of certainty. I could no longer simply make a pronouncement without asking my patient to ask me, how certain am I that this is a good idea? How certain am I it'll help me? It was enlightened clinical care. In fact, that's the discordance. In the time when we actually can be far more enlightened in our relationship with a patient one at a time, we are less and less able to have the enlightened conversation. As I like to teach, it ought to be possible so that no patient ever again has to ask a doctor, what would you do? It ought to be possible that the question for the 21st century is, doctor, what would you do if you were me?
Why is that harder to have that conversation?
Because that requires establishing trust. And establishing trust requires time. It requires proclivity. It requires the ability to do that. Having been a medical educator my entire adult life, I can tell you that this country's biggest resource is the tremendous number of exceedingly bright and competent people, men and women, who are physicians, who would be more than happy to practice that way according to their conscience. But we have a perverse medical care system that disallows that. It basically, as I've said for a very long time, if any of the rheumatologists I've trained practiced the way I trained them, they'd starve. So where we're going back to my initial comment about unintended consequences, there are There are unintended consequences of good ideas at a time when medicine ought to be extremely enlightened and a very safe place to go. And nobody ought to say, gee, it's dangerous to go to the hospital, or it's dangerous to go to a doctor, or go to a medical interaction with the notion that I wonder if I can trust what they're saying. That's horrendous. And that's, in fact, a great big part of what's happened in our country in the healthcare delivery system. And as I said, it starts in the 60s with good ideas. One good idea was that in order to license a pharmaceutical, there had to be some evidence that it actually did something that benefited the patient. And furthermore, there had to be some evidence that it didn't do more harm than good.
That sounds like a necessary predicate for using medicine. I don't know.
Well, as I also mentioned, it's a necessary predicate that goes back thousands of years. Mm-hmm. But it's only in the 60s that it came about as a requirement. And it came about by accident. It came about with what's called the thalidomide disaster, mm-hmm. when all of a sudden there were detail people detailing an agent that actually works for the rare woman who's pregnant and has sort of malignant vomiting. But it also has the unintended consequence of causing congenital deformities. And once that happened, the FDA was required by the Kefauver-Harris Amendment to come up with not only something about purity that was already there, not only something about safety that was already there, but something about efficacy, that you had to show that it was more beneficial than harmful before the FDA would license it. And that really is the late 60s.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with a 60-year veteran of the medical world about doctoring now, what it should be, what it is, where we've gone wrong with American healthcare and the doctor-patient relationship, where we could make it right. Dr. Norton Hadler is with me. He's retired or professor emeritus of medicine and microbiology immunology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. His new book is By the Bedside of the Patient, Lessons for the 21st Century Physician. And there is a lot there about what the doctor-patient relationship ideally would be, what the work of the doctor ideally would be, and about where we are right now. You can join us this hour. Where have you seen healthcare going right lately? Where have you seen it going wrong? Have you seen the problem Dr. Hadler writes about of hyper-specialization, where everybody's into one piece of you and nobody's into the whole? And doctors, do you share Norton Hadler's concern about how things are going? Have you burned out, retired early, lost some faith in the way things work in our medical system? We've got a lot to look at, and people who want to join you, Dr. Hadler, Terry in Urbana, Illinois. Thank you for calling, Terry. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was wondering why some doctors seem to really be interested in care, spend the time with their patients, and others push them out. My son's pediatrician is one of those doctors. He takes the time. And then my doctor, I can't feel like I have enough time to even ask her why I'm there and tell her what's going on.
So why do some get them in and get them out and others will sit and take the time, Norton Hadler?
Well, I think there are very, very few generalizations to that question there. The physician in the current environment who takes the time is doing it with very limited reimbursement. So it depends a lot on how the practice is structured. Let me go back to setting the stage a bit mm-hmm. more, because mm-hmm. I did it with the FDA and I want to do it with Medicare, because Medicare had the same Achilles heel that the Affordable Care Act has. Medicare was passed in the 60s also, about 60 years after our sister countries had very, very important safety nets for the health of the aging population. We didn't. And it was a travesty. And Johnson was going to get LBJ was going to get Medicare through, but there was getting it through Congress was not easy, and the only way it could happen was with a compromise. Mm-hmm. And the Medicare compromise was with the powers at the AMA at that point, which had an awful lot of the power. And he said to the AMA, okay, if you will give me Medicare, I will let you, the doctors, decide who should be treated for what and at what cost. George Bernard Shaw knew better than that. Mm. It took about 10 years before abuses set into that system, and we'll get there in a moment. So we now have set up the FDA to license pharmaceuticals. They, by the way, have a very different licensing mechanism for devices. And if we have time, we'll get to that. But for some pharmaceuticals, there must be evidence of efficacy.
And what is the problem with the FDA decisions of the 60s? And we get how doctors setting their own rates and how that could be corrupting, but and those decisions. But what's the problem with having an FDA sign off on drugs?
There's no intrinsic problem. It was long overdue. The issue is the process. So what happened with the development of efficacy measures is we developed a whole new field called biostatistics. It had been sort of an orphan corner of mathematics until the Kefauver-Harris amendments. And there had been extremely important advances in how do you study efficacy of drugs. Most of it devolves down to whether or not you're likely to see a benefit more than chance alone would predict. But how likely and how much benefit was left for some free-floating kind of notion by the FDA. So any benefit, in essence, more than any toxicity, mm-hmm. in essence, would lead to licensure. That has led to what I call small effectology, a tremendous number of drugs that are studied on very large populations in order to come up with a statistically significant outcome that is clinically far from impressive, often trivial. So if I told you that a drug is effective and I base that advice on data that suggests I would have to treat many, many, many people for a long time to mm-hmm. advantage one, mm-hmm. that offers you as the patient the power to say thanks but no thanks. Mm-hmm. And that's disappeared in our discussions. What's also disappeared is the tremendous need to come up with a statistically significant outcome, such a big need that there's an industry testing drugs hoping to find a very small effect.
For what may be a trivial benefit.
When you sit down one-on-one with a patient and explain the data for licensure, and it comes out saying, look, there's a 80% chance that you'll be dead in a year, but if I give you this drug, there's only a 20% chance you'll be dead in a year, that's easy. Mm-hmm. That's easy. Mm-hmm. It's easy to explain it. It's easy to understand it. It's easy for the patient to value the difference. And it's even easy for the patient to factor in what's the personal expense of the mm-hmm. treatment in terms of toxicity. I never enter into the money discussion. That's a separate discussion. Mm-hmm. It's more an issue in efficacy. But if I tell you that this drug may give you an extra month, or maybe you'll die at the same time with a smaller tumor, or maybe you're different because we have 9 trials that could show no benefit, for example, coronary artery stenting, mm-hmm. and you still want to have a coronary artery stent. If you want it, it ought to be with the understanding that we've studied it in 9 populations, all of which are important examples of people who you would hope would be benefited. And we couldn't show any benefit, and you still want the – that's a very different informed medical decision that empowers the patient rather than the usual, which is this is what we do.
But drugs – so drugs or procedures that may not have much benefit but a system that still may push toward them. And the Medicare compromise you spoke of with LBJ and the American Medical Association that let them decide what to treat and what to charge for it – the outcome, the unanticipated outcome of that?
Excellent. Okay, so how do you implement that? Well, the answer is you implement that by trying to, over time, reduce the clinical event to its component parts.
Meaning the patient's meeting with the doctor?
Everything is charged, billed separately. It started out in 1966 with the CPT, which is a book that's published frequently by the AMA, which lists the procedures that we do for evaluating and managing. Okay. There are over 10,000 procedures.
And each one with a price tag.
That got so cumbersome that a group of Yale scholars put together what are called products, which is a cluster of things we do, a disease-related grouping, which is based on the disease definition, which as of now is another tens of thousands. In fact, this is based on tables of diseases that were designed for totally different reasons. Mm. And then you add to that the physician's fees, and there's a committee that looks at the resource-based relative value scale and updates the value of the physician's time. By the way, that committee has about 21 members. Most of them are from interventional subspecialties who, by the way, consider what they do very valuable.
Yes, I'm sure.
When you're done, you have this giant thing called coding, which has produced an institution like mine has hundreds of people. Many of them are very bright and highly trained, doing nothing more than making sure we didn't overcode or undercode or miss a code. So in order to implement the Medicare
notion— Which will determine
notion,
what you're paid, I guess. Mm-hmm.
It determines all of it, mm-hmm. what the hospital is paid, what Medicare pays. And for many of these coding systems, Blue Cross Blue Shield uses the same coding or other private carriers, but will negotiate with different institutions for how much a code is worth.
So bring this down, if you can, to our caller from Urbana, Illinois, who's concerned that when she goes in to see her doctor, they barely have an exchange. Does that flow out of what you've just described somehow?
Oh, it's worse than that. My guess is her doctor spends most of the brief time worrying about entering all of the right words into
codes.
The computer for coding. And that's the next step. The notion was that if we really can reduce the experience of illness to its component parts that are measurable, we would have a very efficient healthcare delivery system. Mm-hmm. And the notion grows out of two misunderstood aspects of industrial engineering. One is the notion from Deming, which he developed helping Toyota after mm-hmm. World War
Quality
II.
Quality control, yeah.
You've got it. But even Deming knew that there was a component to quality that had to do with human factors. In fact, Adam Smith, who invented the notion of the free market, understood there was an invisible hand 250 years ago that worked on this. And that's called human factors. But no one is explaining to anybody that human factors is called medicine. That we're much more interested in the human factors than the coding. We're much more interested in how well the patient feels or how the patient copes when they don't feel well than we are with the components. However, when you design a system around coding, around
components.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's worse than that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the woman from Champaign-Urbana, mm-hmm. in the world of healthcare, is not a patient going to her doctor. She's a unit of care, and her doctor is no longer a doctor. The doctor is a provider, and the funding of that doctor's office is based on throughput. It's the same notion that we expect McDonald's to have when it produces hamburgers.
A factory model. Let me get another call because it makes it real for all of our listeners and this conversation. Stafford, Vermont. Keith, you're on with Norton Hadler.
Hi, Tom. I'm a 34-year-old carpenter dealing with severe back pain for the last 4 years. Mm. And I have to travel 3.5 hours round trip to the Spine Center in Burlington, where I've seen my doctor 2 times for a total of 7 minutes. I left both times in tears, not really from the pain from my injury, but more from the frustration about not feeling like I was heard or even cared about. The doctor just seemed to have better things or more things going on, and it's not the first time, and I doubt it'll be the last.
A 3.5-hour drive, 2 3.5-minute visits. Why so fast, Keith? Did you get satisfaction?
No. I went in, and he said what he had to say. He didn't listen to what I was talking about, and, you know, he made his own assumptions and just left before I could even get any questions answered.
Dr. Hadler, do you have a consult for Keith?
Yes, Keith. My research career started out as a physical biochemist, and then early on in the 70s, I was referred a patient with complaints similar to yours. And I knew nothing about it, and closed my lab and spent my career studying what I call the illness of working capacity. One of the series of books I decided to write, when I decided to write this series of books, and the one we're talking about today is the sixth of the seven I planned. Back a couple of books is a book called Stabbed in the Back, which explains the extraordinarily complicated context in which you are living out your experience of persistent back pain. And for me to get into it right now as a scholar talking about the context would be more than the hour we have.
But how could it be a 3.5-minute consultation for somebody with a important, serious back pain?
Well, actually, everybody with important serious back pain has important serious back pain.
Yeah.
But many also have another component of the illness, which we tend to call suffering. And sometimes the suffering is much more the issue than the pain. However, the pain clinic, by its very name, nature, and funding, treats pain. So my guess is, and it's just a guess, that you went in there and had a wonderful question, what's your pain score today? And you were supposed to tell them on a scale of 0 to 10, whether or not you were 6.2. Mm. And they adjusted your drugs, and they made sure that you aren't peddling your drugs out on the street. Mm. And that was called a pain clinic visit. But you actually have a far more complex and far more important illness than just the pain. And in fact, you know that because otherwise the drugs would have worked ages ago. There's something else going on here in your experience. And that requires a lot more than 3 minutes. The pain clinic is focused on the magnitude of pain and not the magnitude of suffering. So that's their business model. That's what our country expects of them. And
Keith,
that's
left in tears. That can't be that fun for the doctor at the other end either.
I know a lot of doctors who practice in pain clinics with persistent back pain as the major illness that they're dealing with. I know very few of them that are happy in their work.
You write about people right across the medical profession, doctors in particular, retiring early, looking to get out. Is it because they're on this production line, this assembly line of medical treatment?
There are many reasons that people experience job dissatisfaction, and I don't belittle any of them. Part of it can be these funny words like burnout. But, you know, for me, medicine has been a mission. It's been a lifetime experience. It's not just my job. And I know many of my former students and many of my colleagues who approached their career in that fashion. And if that's your approach to the care of the patient, we have a very perverse system that makes it very hard to persist in that mission. And I know of many physicians who are tired of spending most of their working day entering data, so-called data, because they're not particularly meaningful, into a computer model that wants to chug out a coding event that is even less meaningful. So at some point, if you can, you say, what am I doing? And if you say that, it's very hard to find a place where you can have a healing mission as opposed to a cog in a very large wheel.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with a 60-year veteran of the medical world about doctoring now, what it should be, what it is, where we may have gone wrong with American healthcare, and the doctor-patient relationship, and hopefully what might make it right. Dr. Norton Hadler is with us from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, author of many books about the world of medicine, 45 years plus as a doctor himself, professor emeritus at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. His new book is By the Bedside of the Patient, Lessons for the 21st Century Physician. Dr. Hadler comments for you here. Tracy says, I left my hematologist with a diagnosis yesterday. She spent 5 minutes talking to me. I have 100 questions today. It's me and Google. Allison writes, I love my doctor. We're a team, but insurance and managed care stifle this. Armand says, I'm a practicing physician in primary care. Medicare and insurance rules require extensive documentation, coding for billing purposes. It takes me 15 minutes to see a patient, another 15 minutes to do the documentation, to justify the billing. Paperwork is drowning doctors and distracting them from actual patient care. Then Ramon writes, my two-minute break between patients is over, got to go. That seems to be the rhythm you're describing, Dr. Adler.
It's the unintended consequences we've been talking about. By the way, beware of Google as your doctor.
Of course, but that's what Tracy's left with, 100 questions, 5 minutes.
I personally find that unconscionable, that this is – that our country and my profession, which I love, is forced into such a posture. The hematologists are highly trained, what are called cognitive physicians. So are rheumatologists such as myself, mm-hmm, which, by the way, in the billing system is considered a negative because what we basically do is think with you and about you as opposed to do something to you there, which, by the way, is well rewarded still in this bizarre system
doing
we call the American healthcare
mm-hmm,
system.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I don't I can't excuse it. It's why I wrote this book. It's why 10 years ago I decided to write this series of books, because the profession I love and the patients I care about are being poorly treated in this country. My profession as an institution has a very rusty moral compass. It's not the fault of the profession itself. It's the fault of the development over time of the unintended consequences that turned the experience of illness into something you might code, and that all you had to do is come out with so-called outcome measures, most of which are totally irrelevant to the notion of health. They have no predictive value, have no meaning. The Washington Post once did an article on me as the doctor who wouldn't let you check his cholesterol or his PSA, and that's years ago. This is not health. This is cholesterol is a minor risk factor. If I sat you down and you hadn't had a heart attack and I explained to you what you're getting in terms of benefit from taking these drugs, many of you would say thanks but no thanks. But very few of you have had the time spent to take you through the efficacy data that allowed the FDA to license them, that allowed the drug companies to market them, that made them part of the notion of health in a structural way, so that if you're not checking hemoglobin A1C, which, by the way, is another totally meaningless thing to check, you can be docked in our country. By the way, the reason it's meaningless is not that we don't know what it means. It means your average blood sugar. The reason it's clinically meaningless is, yes, we can lower your hemoglobin A1C, but have you ever asked your doctor, Doc, if you lower my hemoglobin A1C, how certain are you that it will save me from any of the clinically important catastrophes associated with a high blood sugar, mm-hmm. such as a stroke, a heart attack, an ulcer around my foot, a major event like that? And you will get, if your doctor knows this literature, a very surprising set of answers. That essentially there are some minor changes we can expect over time that are subclinical, that you wouldn't know about them.
Wow.
But we're really not able to show that we've saved a life, a heart, a stroke, a kidney. We even though we have now a new oral hypoglycemic agent on the market, seems to be every other month.
But the system says do it. Robert in Miami, Florida, you're on with Dr. Norton Hedler.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. Hello, Robert.
I'm a physician practicing in Miami, and in my waiting room I have a sign that says, Dr. Mitchell's mission statement is to provide legitimate medical services that people need, that they want, that they can afford without insurance, because I believe that these private, predatory, profit-driven insurance companies promote wealth care, and that we need socialized medicine in the United States so people can get proper health care.
Why would socialized medicine, how would it change things, in your view, Robert?
Dramatically. It wouldn't necessarily mean that every person could get everything, but you would take all the money that's now being spent on CEO salaries and bonuses and advertising, and you could redirect all those billions of dollars back into a single-payer system that would at least allow everyone to have a basic, necessary level of health care where people are not destitute and required to turn to emergency room services for treatment of pneumonias that could have been treated properly as common colds in an office setting if they had access, which they don't today under the current system.
Dr. Hedler, how about it? It's predatory health insurance, for-profit operations. You write a lot about bloated salaries and the money that goes to the top. Robert in Miami says, forget it. Let's go single payer.
Well, a number of terms came out. The answer is something like this. The usual estimate is about 20% of the GDP of this country is committed to something called health care. I actually think it's much, much higher than that if you factor in such things as the number of people wandering around the placebo aisle at Whole Foods. Mm-hmm. But let's start at 20%. At least half of that, the Institute of Medicine said 30%, but at least half of that is not spent in other countries per capita with better health outcomes that are measured in terms of longevity and the like. So there is a tremendous amount of money in the American healthcare delivery system that is hard to ascribe to anybody's notion of benefit of the individual patient. So we're not talking about an issue in money. The system is swimming in money. Then we get these words that go back. Socialized medicine was a term introduced in at the time of the Medicare debates. It was meant to engender some sort of fear of socialism, of communism, of a bad thing. And single payer means different things to different people. I think what the caller from Florida is trying to tell us, and I think he's absolutely right, is we need to redo American health. It can't be tweaked. It's sort of lost its way. It's gone off the rails. The American healthcare delivery system delivers very little healthcare for the amount of money we're spending and has major issues with access to healthcare, defining health the way we tried to at the beginning of this interview. I'm not sure, by the way, that I applaud the boutique medicine movement. I understand it. It tends to stratify our already over-stratified country. I actually think health access to good medical advice ought to be a given, and that's what you want. You want good medical advice. You want to be able to have an interaction that allows you to make choices based on your values and not based on other people's values.
If things have gone off the rails, as you say, how do you see the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, factoring into that? And beyond that, what rails would you put our system on? How would you do it? What would look better?
Well, as I mentioned about Medicare, Obamacare, in the early drafts of this enormously complex and enormous bill, was loaded with the four-letter word COST. And it was redlined out in committee. And so Obamacare
cost,
is
you mean,
headed.
Don't talk yeah. about cost because what? In the fact, industry did not want a focus on cost?
Whatever the lobbying groups were involved, and the industry is it's like healthcare, it's hard to define, but there are an awful lot of vested interest in this 20% of the GDP. Mm-hmm. So yes, in fact, PCORI, which is supposedly committed to looking at value of interventions, was disallowed from considering cost effectiveness. They, by law, they are not allowed to discuss the cost.
Wow.
So Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, I think is following Medicare right over the cliff. It's unsustainable. It is going to bankrupt a lot of people. There are going to be a lot of people who are going to be surprised at their deductibles and their copays.
And yet you write that you fervently agree that health care should now be an unalienable right. Obamacare was, in its conception, trying to push toward that, wasn't it?
So was Medicare. This is not mm-hmm. bad people or bad ideas. It's unintended consequences of some of the compromises. So I don't talk about it much. I've written several editorials about it, but pursuing a totally novel, different way to think about this thing called health care.
Let's hear it.
Even to the extent of trying to introduce a bill in another state for a form of health care for the uninsured worker, and crashed and burned about 10 years ago, but came out of that experience much wiser for it. And we're very close right now. In fact, I can almost tell you that that we have real traction for a totally different way to think about healthcare, and we have a population where we think we're going to be allowed to introduce it. Now, you have to realize that all healthcare is state-based in this country, mm-hmm. with the exception of Medicare. Mm-hmm. And that is a historical accident. When workers' compensation came across the ocean in 1910, based on the Commerce Clause, the Supreme Court said that it cannot be a national scheme. So workers' comp is state-based. And when health insurance came about in our country, which is before World War II at the Baylor Hospital, it became state-based too. And there's nothing you can do. It's why you in Boston can't buy a Connecticut Blue Cross
right,
Blue Shield
right.
policy.
Describe your new model. I'm sure everybody's listening to hear what the framework would be that would put things on a better footing, to your mind.
Well, let me give a couple of provisos. There's a bit of this that's counterintuitive and irrational. It is not what I would have done in 1912. In 1912, I would have voted for Teddy Roosevelt and I would have joined the AMA. I missed both. So we're dealing with this enormous structure in the United States of America that most Americans think is really good if we're only affordable. Mm-hmm. And has a tremendous – there are six lobbyists for every member of Congress. This is not an easy thing to move. So I decided that you can't. You just can't reform okay. American health care. Okay. You have to design an alternative program. And so I've been, as I said, working at this for 25 years. For the past decade, I have a colleague who's this absolutely extraordinary risk manager, attorney, accountant, and we've been playing off each other.
Take us to the heart of it. We have 4 minutes.
Okay, 4 minutes to reform American health care. What we decided to do was back to the caller's question about his backache. I've been talking for ages that America made a big mistake when we called a backache an injury. It created almost all the opiate abuse and a tremendous amount of unnecessary surgery because it became an injury compensable in the workplace. And then I said, wait a minute, if we're crazy enough as a nation to call a backache an injury, why not call a headache an injury? Why not call anything an injury? Mm-hmm. If you do that, I can create a healthcare system under the rubric of workers' compensation, an employer-sponsored healthcare mm-hmm. program mm-hmm. for the employees of large companies. The next thing I said is we're absolutely insane to have everybody else determine what's done, and it ought to be totally driven by patients' needs. And the way you do that is you create a fiduciary system. So this is a defined It's not a defined benefit. It's a defined contribution plan. A certain percentage of salary, 2% in fact, will be put into a pot. And that will cover benefits. And benefits will include what we now call health, what we now call disability, what we now call comp, and what we now call life insurance.
Okay.
It's a the company will put in a multiple, a threefold multiple. So the whole thing will cost about 8% of wages, which for this program is way up there with such inefficient
And how would it change the world? How would it change the world?
So the next part of it is that we have a component of this program that says that if there's good evidence that the intervention is ineffective, has no benefit, it need not be covered. When you do that and model it for a large employer, about half of the money will remain at the end of the year to return to the employee as a what's called a wrap, the ability to buy ancillary insurance that we don't cover. So if you need obstetrics, you buy an obstetrics policy. If you don't need obstetrics, you don't buy an obstetrics policy. This will be as close as we can make it for one segment of the population, the working man and woman of a large employer. They will almost certainly have the kind of benefits package that includes health and disability and comp and that I would want for my children and my grandchildren.
And the doctor working within that system, we've got a minute. Would they be closer to the idol that you
almost everything is based on the primary care patient-physician interaction. That, by the way, is reimbursed without any coding at all. It's reimbursed just on the point of contact. There is even an annuity built in so that if you don't force the patient into something that's known to be ineffective, you will get your payment plus 50% over time.
And might the real doctor that you dream of being working as reemerge in such a system?
That's the whole point of it. So cross your fingers. We're very close to getting permission to try this in another state. We should know. We got a green light last week. And I will believe it when it happens. 25 years of trying, and I'm still trying.
We will follow, and we wish you well with it. Norton Hadler.
That's, by the way, in Chapter 9 of this book. They made me introduce it just like you did.
The book is By the Bedside of the Patient, Lessons for the 21st Century Physicians. Terrific read. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Dr. Norton Hadler, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.